From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama in Wales today to strategize with NATO allies. Russia's moves in Ukraine at the center of their agenda. They want to say, don't mess too much with Ukraine and don't dream of messing with NATO with Europe. But how strong is Europe these days? How strong a partner? This hour on Point, Europe's economy and more in trouble as a new challenge rises from Russia. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see a strong partner in Europe strong enough? If this is half the West, how's the West looking? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Wales, where NATO leaders have been meeting, is Griff Whitty, London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Griff, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be here, Tom.
Russia says Ukraine don't even think of joining NATO, but there's the Ukrainian president at the NATO meeting. What's he doing there?
Well, he's here to meet with leading NATO figures, including President Obama, and they had that meeting earlier today. What he really wants is a show of support from NATO. Obviously, Ukraine is not a NATO member. It's outside the bounds of the mutual defense treaty that has been so important in terms of maintaining the peace for decades. But it would like closer relations with NATO, and in fact, it would like to join NATO. But NATO members have made very clear that they're not interested in welcoming Ukraine to the club right now. And there's actually a limit to how much NATO can actually do at this point to support Ukraine and to influence the course of the conflict there.
Griff, does this meeting feel more about Ukraine or more about reasserting that NATO itself is inviolable and an attack on one is an attack on all?
Well, I think most of the rhetoric is going to be around Ukraine. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about the limited ways that NATO can support Ukraine. And President Poroshenko will be speaking. He's been given a featured speaking role at the summit, so we'll be hearing from him a little bit later today. But I think that on balance, the summit is really about deterring Russia, and it's about sending a very clear message to Russia that the countries that are within the bounds of NATO that are protected under Article 5 of the NATO Charter, which says that an attack on one is an attack on all, that those countries are protected. And that's why you saw President Obama go to Estonia yesterday, one of the nations that's considered most vulnerable to possible Russian advances, and really assert that the U.S. is there to protect Estonia and the other nations that are on the leading edge of the border, leading edge of the struggle with Russia.
Talk of a new rapid reinforce response of 4,000 troops from NATO that could deploy within 48 hours. One might have thought that would already be there, Griff. Didn't NATO have that kind of capacity for rapid response before? Did that erode after the end of the Cold War?
Well, you would think that this would be something that was just a basic function of NATO, but in fact, it's not. There have been efforts to create a rapid response force in the past, but the results have been fairly meager. There was a force that was created a number of years ago, but it's only been used once, and it takes called a rapid response force, it takes quite some time to actually get it mobilized. And so the difference here, or the supposed difference, is that this is a force that could be mobilized within a matter of hours. But it will be very interesting to see in the details that come out about this force, just how significant it is, where it's stationed, and really just how much of a tool it really is in terms of deterring Russia.
How much of that 4,000 would be American troops? Is that clear?
That's not clear. That's not been announced. The composition of American forces is certainly something that Europe is watching closely and that Russia is going to be watching closely, but there has been no announcement on that.
We have also word that France may be backing away from delivering these big warships to Russia, the kind of warships that would hypothetically be used against Ukraine or hypothetically Latvia or Estonia. Hollande there saying he needed to bring some coherence to their policy, and you know, sending these to Russia while this tension was so high didn't add up. Is it clear that France is backing away from that? Where does that stand?
Well, they're backing away at least temporarily, but over the long term, they're saying essentially this is not the right time to deliver the first of these two warships to Russia. But they haven't said anything about the longer term, and if this crisis subsides, perhaps that deal will go forward as planned. But in the short term, it does send a message, and it's intended to take some of the criticism away. Obviously, the French have come under a great deal of scrutiny for continuing to send warships to Russia. The Germans have come under scrutiny for their energy ties to Russia. The British have a lot of financial connections to Russia. Europe is very deeply intertwined with Russia at this point economically, and so any moves against Russia are going to hurt back here in Europe.
You know, Vladimir Putin does not seem to have blinked in the face of some significant sanctions so far. What's Europe's sense of its own leverage, its own confidence level? How do you read it, Griff?
Well, the Russian economy, there are signs that it's hurting. The ruble has been taking a real slide lately. But Putin has basically been sending the message that he's going to go forward with what Russia is doing in Ukraine regardless, and he's willing to take the hit of economic pain in order to make sure that at least part of Ukraine stays in Russia's orbit, which is very, very important to him and to Russian decision makers in terms of their sphere of influence, in terms of their sense of what the balance of power in Europe looks like.
As NATO leaders sit down today in Wales, Griff Whitty is covering the summit for the Washington Post. He's London bureau chief there. Griff, thank you very much for joining us from Wales.
Thanks so much, Tom.
NATO's strength, of course, goes back to the economies of its member nations. Europe's economy has slumped again lately. Joining me now from London is Elaine Moore, capital markets correspondent for the Financial Times. Elaine, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What has been the trend line over this summer for Europe's economy? What's happened?
Well, what's happened is that these geopolitical tensions couldn't have come really at a worse time. So when we went into the summer, things actually looked quite good. Europe appeared to be climbing out of the euro debt crisis. But as the summer has progressed, the economic data that's come out of some of the eurozone's biggest economies has defied expectations. So Italy has fallen back into recession. French economic growth has flatlined. Germany, the largest economy in the eurozone, the economic output is falling back down. So you may well have seen today that the European Central Bank has announced new measures to try to address this lack of growth, to try to stimulate some kind of movement. It's questionable whether it will be enough. There's a lot of arguments going on right now about the economic future of the eurozone. So what's happening with Russia, the economic sanctions, that isn't helping the situation at all.
The European Central Bank, it almost looks like they're picking up a Federal Reserve kind of policy here, cutting interest rates again and saying they're going to get into the asset buying business that the Fed has been so deep in the United States.
Yeah, it's they're sort of trying to throw everything but the kitchen sink at this problem. And what's interesting is that the eurozone debt crisis, it was the end crisis. So UK, US went through the peak of their crisis a few years earlier. Then the eurozone debt crisis happened. So as US and UK economies are recovering, Europe has gone completely sluggish. So they're looking into using the same measures that have been used in other countries. What they're reluctant to do is the full-blown bond buying program that has been employed by the US and the UK. And right now there's huge arguments going on between economists, investors, business leaders, politicians about whether that needs to happen, whether earlier action needs to be taken, and whether Europe might be facing the sort of lost decade that Japan has faced.
Which would be a pretty serious prospect. With Germany's prodding foremost, Europe kind of went on the austerity path, and that has raised its own questions, as the economy has not come back as strongly as people hoped. We saw not long ago the French economy minister, Arnaud Montebourg, resigned after denouncing those austerity policies that Angela Merkel in Germany had promoted. Here's a press conference where he announced he was leaving the French government. France's economy minister saying here, the politics of austerity, high taxes, and excessive reduction of public funds in use by European governments today are the cause of the prolonged and useless aggravation of the economic crisis. Where does this debate stand, Elaine, over austerity and how it's played out for Europe? Budget cutting.
There's definitely a split between what we call the core European countries, and Germany, as you said, is at the front of that, and the countries that we say are at the peripheral of Europe. These are the countries that have suffered some of the hardest hits and have been put through some of the strongest austerity measures. And those countries, this is Italy, Spain, Greece, those countries you will have seen in the news. There was huge outcry from the people living in those countries. There was anger towards the politicians. There was a feeling that the politicians in those countries countries had accepted terms set by Germany that were not what the people of those countries wanted, and people were protesting on the streets. And that argument is still ongoing. Nobody has resolved it. And because in some ways we're still in the early days of this situation. So like I said, US, UK went through this process, and this is 2 or 3 years earlier than the Eurozone. So we're still, there's still questions about whether the austerity program is actually working. There's been commentators in the FT who say it hasn't worked, it hasn't been useful, and that some other measure needs to be taken, but nobody can agree what that measure needs to be.
Elaine, does Europe have what it takes these days to take on Russia, to defy Moscow, or more than defy, to stare it down?
Well, it's certainly the scariest moment that Europe has faced for a long time. We've had a period of trade and diplomacy with Russia that's lasted for 25 years and that now seems to be grinding to a halt. And as I said, the economic situation is looking far worse than it was just a few months ago. But you have to remember that Europe is the world's second largest economic bloc, that Europe may be one of Russia's largest trading partners, so it swings both ways. The economic sanctions may be hurting Europe, but the European leaders would say that they are having far more of an effect on Russia.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe struggling economically and maybe more as a new challenge rises from Russia, asking if the West has still got game at this fraught moment. In a speech yesterday in Estonia, ahead of the NATO summit in Wales, President Obama said the U.S. and Europe must continue to stand united against Russia's aggression in Ukraine.
The United States, the European Union, our partners around the world have all said we prefer a diplomatic solution. But in light of Russia's unwillingness to seize that opportunity, we have come together to impose major sanctions on Russia for its actions.
Will it add up to a meaningful block on Vladimir Putin? Europe and NATO seeing issues on all sides. Just NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen in Wales today saying member countries have plenty to contend with.
To the east, Russia is attacking Ukraine. To the southeast, we see the rise of a terrorist organization, the so-called Islamic State, that has committed horrific atrocities. To the south, we see violence, insecurity, instability.
Troubles all over, and economic troubles at home in Europe. Is Europe up to this? How do you see Europe as a partner these days? 800-423-8255. We've been talking with Elaine Moore in London, capital markets correspondent for the Financial Times. Joining us now from Washington is Sherzad Rahman. She's professor at the School of Business at George Washington University. She's director of the EU Research Center there. Sherzad Rahman, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
So sum this moment up for us. We've got Vladimir Putin kind of on a roll here. Is NATO in a position to effectively confront bloc pushback?
Well, you know, this is tricky. Putin absolutely sensed the weakness, and the weakness is in the assessment of global risk in the West. The largest risk the West is facing right now is governance failure. And he understood that the U.S. has battle fatigue at this point, and he took advantage of it. You know, there by the grace of God goes Crimea. And he knew he could take it and walk away with it. And then he started, you know, pushing back on the eastern part of Ukraine. And he knew that there was very little anyone could do. Now, they've raised these sanctions. The U.S. has now shifted the marker on a new type of sanctions weapon, and that is access to money and the ability to move it around, mm-hmm. which is probably more potent in the long term than any physical trade sanctions.
Because it goes after Putin's rich supporters in Russia, or because it undercuts Russian business itself?
All of the above. You know, it'll be hard for Russian firms to borrow. It's scaring investors. And it's contributing the billions of dollars in capital flight, that is wounding the Russian economy.
When you say Putin looks out and sees weakness, sees governance failure, are you talking about the U.S. Congress, Capitol Hill, or are you talking about the EU?
Both. In the U.S., you know, we have a White House that is cautiously disengaging from the rest of the world. And there have been many, many articles in the recent weeks about Obama's lack of response to all the various crises stemming from the Middle East all the way through Africa. So part of that is that we do have battle fatigue in the United States. In the EU, they are extremely self-absorbed about the economic troubles as they should be. As you know, with the speaker right before you, the Europeans are very, very slowly trying to get out of this economic mess that they're in because they failed to do serious crisis management up front, which they are trying to do right now. So it's very, very hard. Everyone's distracted. Everyone's weakened. What, you know, better time to create a little confusion on any border where there are Russians, where Putin can claim that his people are affected.
We're thinking of Vladimir Putin eyeing Europe, and for that matter, the whole transatlantic alliance, thinking about its power and its readiness to defend its borders, push back. Elaine Moore, people look first of all at Europe's vulnerability on the energy front, the economic front, and those are intertwined. What about Europe's vulnerability to Russia's sanctions? They've stopped, said they're going to stop bringing in food from Europe, or a lot of it anyway. What kind of political response is that eliciting in Europe, Elaine?
You're right. So Russia is the largest foreign importer of fruit and vegetables from the EU. There's been huge concern from particular countries. The Norwegian fish industry, for example, exports a huge amount of its produce to Russia. And as you said, there's also this issue of gas. So Russia supplies about a third of European gas demands. Europe has been weaning itself off Russian natural gas over recent years because we have seen problems in the past, and there was an awareness that there needed to be a change in the way that Europe supplied its own energy. The rhetoric that's been coming from European leaders is, first of all, that the economic sanctions that Russia is putting in place are going to hurt Russia and Russian consumers more than they're going to hurt Europe, and that this is more about a political fight from Putin. The second thing that Europe has been doing is stating very clearly that there will be support for the industries that are affected. So there's already been an announcement that European farmers who are affected, that there is a supply of money in reserve waiting to help them if this turns into a long, drawn-out process that really hammers them. So Europe's been very keen to make it clear that this is an unpleasant situation. It's not helping anybody, and it's bad timing, but that the union has the ability to look after itself.
Sherzad, this is partly about economics, who can afford what. It's partly about morale, I guess, and determination, grit and guts. I mean, Putin can sort of, it seems, require Russians to pull in their belts. And if Russian consumers get hit, you know, maybe they like McDonald's, but they're being closed down anyway in Russia. Does Europe have the grit and guts these days to get into this again, Sherzad?
Yeah, you know, and I slightly disagree with the previous speaker, you know.
Elaine Moore of the Financial Times in London.
That's correct. You know, and rightly so, you know, all these governments are assuring their producers that if they get hit, and basically Russia is the second largest food export market for the EU, you know, it's about 10% of their market. And so, yes, budgets have been put aside for these farmers. But the bottom line is, we're in very severe austerity cuts right now. You know, where is the money going to come from?
In Europe.
That's exactly correct. And so while it's okay to say that we're going to look after you regardless of what the Russians do, coming up with the money and having more pressure on the budgets is not going to help these countries in the long run, especially when the markets are looking at them and the recovery is flatlining in most of these countries, if not negative growth.
Editorial writers in the United States are saying that Europeans will obviously have to do more. This is the New York Times editorial, including increasing defense budgets. Do they have the resources, the economies, to do that, Sherzad?
The bottom line is no, they don't. You know, the European Central Bank is trying to shore up these countries as best as possible. I think what gets lost in the mix here is right now the ECB, the European Central Bank, is still doing unlimited bond buying for Italy and for Spain. And they have created the single banking authority to funnel money in case some of these countries start getting into trouble again through their banking system. You know, Europe is not out of the woods yet when it comes to liquidity, especially for certain countries like Italy and Spain.
Let's go to our callers. Chuck in Frankfort, Kentucky. Chuck, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a question about what would happen if Russia cuts off the natural gas to Europe and if they have an alternative source of supply.
Let's go straight to Europe. to Germany to look to answer that. Chuck, I appreciate your call. With us right now from Brussels, actually, is German Stefanie Weiss. She is project manager for Bertelsmann Stiftung. It's a think tank based in Germany. Stefanie Weiss, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello from Brussels.
Yes, nice to have you with us. You hear our listeners' question there about Europe and Russian gas. A lot of Americans look out at that. Europeans, too, no doubt, and worry. Winter is coming, as they say in Game of Thrones over here. Can Vladimir Putin make Europe dance to his tune by threatening to cut off those gas supplies?
Of course, that would be a nightmare scenario. Germany, for example, would sustain without Russian gas for at least 4 to 5 months, but countries like Bulgaria and Slovenia and the Czech Republic will be hurt immediately, and there is no way to substitute this very easily. But, I mean, one has also to think of if that is really something Putin would take on, then we are in a kind of all-out war, you know. And probably other things come to the floor than discussing if this is an appropriate sanction. I mean, when we talk about sanctions, we always have to remind ourselves that we think that the counterpart and we ourselves are acting rational. If that's not the case, then we are in a totally awkward situation. And I think that is what we have to remind us. I don't think personally that Putin will sanction threat or will use this threat, because this is devastating for him as much as it is devastating for Europe, and we would have really we would be in an even worse scenario, more worse scenario than we were in the Cold War early days.
Yeah, because of that energy dependence that you have now, because of the presumption built over years that the Cold War dynamic was behind us. It was over. When Germans look at the European economy and your geopolitical, your strategic situation now, are Germans worried, Stefanie Weiss?
Germans are not worried that much. I mean, they look at Russia and the Ukrainian crisis as they look to the south, and of course they feel very uncomfortable. But I think the feeling in Germany still is that there will be a diplomatic exit to the situation found, and that it is a lot of saber rattling still go on, but that they will find a diplomatic solution. And I think everyone hopes that there will be a diplomatic solution to this adventure we are facing at the moment. So in Germany, they are still, in a way, calm and worried, but hopeful that there will be a positive outcome.
Yeah, aren't we all? We're talking about Europe struggling as a new challenge rises from Russia. Let's get a caller from Atlanta, Georgia. Jonathan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Just to remind you what NATO was set up to do, the first Secretary General of NATO commented that it was designed to do three things: keep America in, keep Russia out, and keep Germany down. And it's been very successful in several of those areas. And it quite correctly reestablished its eastern border on the western border of Ukraine. Ukraine is indefensible from the west against a determined attack from the east. And probably made an error in guaranteeing the borders of the Baltics. You may remember that in 1939, Britain and France gave guarantees to several countries in Eastern Europe being threatened by Nazi Germany. When those promises were called, the British and the French could do nothing about it.
So, Jonathan, is your point that Europe ought to, in fact, needs to cool its jets a little bit here, not be so aggressive in pushing NATO's borders toward Russia's face?
Absolutely.
Jonathan, let us pick it up. I appreciate your call. Sherzad, maybe the problem here is Europe slash NATO slash the United States overreach.
You know, in part, you know, the caller is correct because Ukraine made very strong overtures towards the EU and the EU responded back. And this rattled Putin a little bit, you know, and strategically, Putin's biggest mistake moving forward would be if he touched any of the Baltics, because that gives NATO an excuse then to deploy whatever means they believe then would be necessary. As long as he stays out of the Baltics, like Estonia and so forth, which are members of NATO, he's actually okay. And if there is a political solution to this, which we hope it will be, you know, he walks away with Crimea and certain parts of Ukraine. And then he settles in until the next time.
But Putin famously has said that the biggest, mistake in history or something grand like that was the breakup of the Soviet Union. I mean, if he coolly assesses the current strength of the United States and Europe, the West, maybe he'll decide that why not have Estonia or Latvia back in the fold? What's NATO really going to do? I mean, he's even rattling the nuclear button. He's brought it up.
Sure, he has, but the trick now is to take it. You know, he's playing a very smart game. He's taking two steps forward, one step sideways, one step backwards. You know, he does the aggression, then he decides he wants to have the talks, and then nothing happens for a little while, and then there's more aggression, and then we're back to peace talks again. So he's not going to go an all-out affront on Ukraine. This is going to be a long, drawn-out process where he is eating territories piece by piece, which makes it much harder for us in the West than to react in one big way.
Elaine Moore in London, do Londoners see NATO as having overreached here? Are they prepared now to accept Russia eating away at what these new boundaries are post-Cold War, despite the assertions in the last 24 hours? Once again, an attack on one is attack on all.
I don't think so. I think that what you hear from politicians and what you will see in newspapers in the UK in particular appears to be a sympathetic view towards the Ukraine. And the Ukraine is saying that Russia wants to recreate the USSR and it wants some kind of definite action. And NATO has been saying it will do something, but it's been quite cautious about not explicitly stating what that action might be. So there's a view that this is about Russian antagonism.
And Stephanie, we've just got you for another minute. Is Germany ready to compromise with Russia? Merkel has talked tough, but in the end, will she compromise?
I don't think that it's a question of compromising. Obviously there is no military solution, or we go to an all-out war. And I mean, the question is how the compromise, and I mean, this is diplomacy or that is foreign policy, will look like, and it shouldn't be to the detriment of the independence or sovereignty of the Ukraine. Also, we have to digest that the Crimean peninsula is lost, but we have to be forcefully. But I mean, there is no military option, and that is what Merkel is telling again and again, and I don't see that the United States or other countries see that there is a military option at the table we could pursue. So one has to talk with Putin, and one has to find a compromise to stop him.
A compromise maybe based on some economic rough stuff here, but the strength in Europe on that front, not limitless at all these days either. Stephanie Weiss with the Bertelsmann Stiftung joining us from Brussels, Belgium. Thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe struggling economically and maybe more as a new challenge rises from Russia, asking if the West has still got game, if it's still on its game. Elaine Moore is with us from the Financial Times, joining us from London. Sherzad Rahman is with us, director of the EU Research Center at George Washington University, joins us from Washington. The president of the United States talking in Estonia yesterday about NATO ready to be there with the United States front and center.
If in such a moment you ever ask again who will come to help, you'll know the answer. The NATO alliance, including the armed forces of the United States of America, right here, present now.
Ready to go, says the President of the United States. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, this was last week at a meeting of EU ministers, warning Russia could face tougher sanctions, economic sanctions, as a result of the escalation of the Ukrainian conflict. Here she is, interpreted by Deutsche Welle.
In March this year, we made it clear that if the situation escalated further, we would have to discuss more sanctions. So the issue will be on the agenda, and we have to answer the question, how do we react?
But where does the line get drawn, and what would the reaction be? Ukraine still pushing. In Wales today, at the NATO summit, talking with reporters there, Ukraine's ambassador to the United Nations, Yuri Sergeyev, said Ukraine not only wants peace, but it wants the Crimea back from Russia.
This is this old Soviet story, to create a problem and then to gamble. So the territorial integrity of Ukraine and Crimea as a part of Ukraine is not discussable. So sooner or later, Crimea will be back. And today we know that the world community supports Ukraine and Crimea is isolated.
Ukraine's ambassador at the UN saying, we don't just want eastern Ukraine, we want Crimea back. Well, so what about it, NATO? Ken in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Ken, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yes. And I was in the military back in the early 80s, late 70s, when the Cold War was going on. And back then, the United States assessment of the Russian military's capabilities was pretty bad. In fact, they call it a mothball military.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering what their capabilities are today, and could they, in fact, stand a war against NATO? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
We should say again that everybody is saying they don't want any war, yet there's always a power equation that gets assessed on both sides, Putin as well. Sherzad Rahman, what about Russia's military, the mothball military label? Is that still the case?
Look, there's definitely truth to that. But I don't think you're going to see a war on a scale that would then require, you know, the United States might militarily against the Russian. I think that those days are gone.
But isn't that what President Obama is talking about when he says America will be here ready to go when he goes to Estonia? He's not talking he's making guarantees to them that have steel in them.
But only through NATO. We're not going to go it alone. And again, you know, the mistake that Putin would make is if he touches one of the Baltic countries, which he's pretty smart. I don't think he's going to touch them, at least not now. This is going to all happen through NATO. It's not going to happen directly from the United States into Russia. I don't believe this, you know, this war scenario, this all-out war scenario is a likely one. Putin's too smart for that. What he will do is engage in skirmishes.
I mean, everybody says that can't happen, though he's not been unafraid to take it to Ukraine on that front. But meanwhile, you've got this weak economy. You've got Russia reasserting its sort of boundary strength, and Estonia and Latvia worried. Stanley in Worcester, Massachusetts. Stanley, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I just returned from Greece. I was there for about 3 weeks.
Okay.
And the sanctions that Russia has imposed in response to the sanctions, you know, that the European Union and the U.S. has imposed, is having an impact on the local populace. For example, you know, Greece is largely agricultural, especially up in the north, and a good deal in the south, and a good deal of the produce that had been picked, packaged, and then shipped off to Russia, actually was the Russian border police didn't allow the trucks to enter Russia, so the produce and everything that was on it started to rot on the trucks, and even produce back in the warehouses in Greece was just rotting because they couldn't ship it out to it. Furthermore, the truck drivers and the people who, you know, rely on the payment for those things, those produce, didn't have money so that they could return back to Greece with their trucks, and was effectively stranded. And the notion that there's some fund set up to help the farmers, I don't know. That sounds more like rhetoric and talk. Where the tire meets the road, it seems as if the local populace, at least the agrarian community, is suffering from this.
There's a first-hand report. Stanley, I appreciate that very much, from Greece, peaches that aren't going over the border to Russia. And yes, maybe there's some subsidy for those farmers, but where the rubber meets the road right now, that hurts. Elaine, what about this over time? Everybody says we don't want to get military. You said Russia is hurting as well, and President Obama says the same. But Europe's pain is right in its own lap and very evident. I mean, does it cut Europe's determination? Does it reduce its determination to really go eyeball to eyeball with Russia when farmers are hurting like that, when gas can be cut off? Can Europe really take on Russia? Or is Russia willing to swallow the pain more than Europe?
I think you're right. I think that was a really interesting perspective. And the interesting thing about this situation is that it's changing day by day. So the information that came out about this fund available for farmers, mm-hmm. that's incredibly recent. Mm-hmm. So we still haven't yet seen how that will play out. One point that is maybe important to bring up is what's happening politically in Europe at the moment. So there's been a rise in right-wing parties who are very anti the European Union, and that's been happening across many different countries, the UK included, actually. And I think that situations like this one, where you have working populations, working people who are directly affected and haven't yet seen any kind of money flowing through from the Union as promised, this could all feed into that. And there's lots of big questions right now about the political future of the European Union.
Well, in the past, a rise of the right wing would have meant a rise in anti-Soviet sentiment as well. Does it still, Elaine?
It's a very internal conversation, actually, right now. So this isn't really about Soviets. It's not about mm-hmm. fascism, communism. This is more about the effect of the austerity regime that's been put in place and the different people that has affected. So there's a feeling that on the ground, there's been a really hard hit taken, and that those, you know, in the upper echelons haven't been affected, and that that country by country, the European Union is not looking after everybody equally. There are some countries who are doing okay. There are some that are really suffering.
Shahrzad, but if that sentiment cuts against the European Union, the EU, doesn't that end up weakening this sort of counterbalance to Russia, to Moscow?
Absolutely. Look, the reality of the situation for the European Union is that no single country there can really sit at the big table anymore. They have to sit as the EU. And the timing is quite unfortunate. You know, you've got a Scottish vote coming up. The UK is making noises.
To break away from the UK, yeah, potentially.
That's correct. You've got, you know, yes, and you've got the UK making noises about coming out of the EU, which would be disastrous for them. You know, so the timing is a little bit off. I think that that Elaine is absolutely right. This rise of the right is in reaction to the economic hardships that were imposed from the financial crisis. And I'll just add one tiny bit here. Putin's going to feel the pain if two things happen. And one of them is going to be oil and gas prices. You know, they drop dramatically. The Russian economy will slow down, and then he will feel internal pressure from the Russians about their living standards. The second is if those monetary sanctions are really put into place in a way that will hurt Russian commerce and investors and increase capital flight out of Russia. So, for example, you know, right now state banks raising capital in the EU markets are being banned. For anybody who's a state-owned firm from Russia, you can't raise money. Capital market borrowing has been banned from syndicated loans from EU banks and so forth. If this continues and you squeeze him, he may be much more likely then to sit at the table and calm down this process into a more peaceful process.
That's the point President Obama was making, among others, in Estonia yesterday, right here.
Capital is fleeing. Foreign investment is plummeting. Because investors know that today's Russia is a bad bet, given its behavior. The Russian economy has slipped into recession. Its energy production, which is the engine of the Russian economy, is expected to drop. Its credit rating is near junk status. The ruble just fell to an all-time low. In short, Russia's actions in Ukraine are weakening Russia.
President Obama saying, in effect, we're on the case. Sanctions are cutting. Derek in New Orleans. Thanks for calling, Derek. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that we had pretty good evidence that Russia shot down a civilian jetliner, and the reaction was what? I mean, he totally got away with that. There was no outrage. It was a slap on the wrist. So no wonder he got emboldened. And the other thing I would like to say is that I think Ukraine is to Russia what Ireland is to England, which is like the perennial stepchild and the last sliver of the empire, and they don't want to give it up.
And they're trying to give up as little as possible. A lot's gone. Derek, I appreciate your call. Shahrzad, what about the Malaysian airliner downing? I mean, Derek just lays that right on Russia's doorstep. What is the evidence at this point on that front? And how do you judge the West's response to that unbelievable loss of life?
And it is such a tragedy in terms of the loss of life. But, you know, the caller is absolutely right. Putin got away with it.
Is it clear? He said Russia did it. Do you accept that as a shortest hand description?
There is absolutely, no concrete proof, of course. You know, clearly the violence on the ground contributed to the airline being brought down. Now, you know, who shot the rocket and how this happened is still murky, but clearly there was some involvement on the ground by the insurgents. And we know that the insurgents are getting help from the Russian government. Now, the direct involvement is a very hard tie to make. But
Still, given what we've seen, the video of tanks going in?
Yeah, the essence of it is, yes, of course, there's Russian support and Russian arms going across the border to help the insurgents, if not Russian troops themselves with unidentified uniforms. But, this is all being claimed. But there was a slap on the wrist only. This was a pretty big deal. But Putin, again, is taking advantage of understanding that the West response now will not be as difficult or as strident as in the past when we talk about the Cold War. The world has changed now. No one's looking for all-out war. No one's going to go into Russia just because a plane was downed. And he understands the new dynamic of the global economy.
You raised the West right there. I mean, that gets to the heart of it. There was a time, of course, it was tested again and again, but that sort of meant an irresistible force. What does it mean now, Sherazad, with economic problems in the United States and governance problems, as you say, with the deeper economic problems in Europe and deeper governance problems there? Is the West still formidable? Is that day behind us?
No, absolutely it is. But I think the days where we are, rolling tanks across borders in Europe, those days are much more limited.
Well, I mean, even in the Cold War, we didn't do that. That's why they called it cold, right? I mean,
that's correct. But I do believe
that. But we just had the power plus nukes in the background, which they have too. But we had the power that people paid attention to. We, i.e., the United States plus Europe. If you're sitting in NATO's shoes, that's we. And I just wonder if that is now history when you add all this up. And if it is, what does that mean?
Yes, I do believe that nuclear option and the deterrence issue is all history. I don't think anyone's wanting to or is even contemplating pressing any buttons anywhere. That world has gone by. There's a new world of sanctions, of money being squeezed, of countries not growing, of internal populace and social unrest when economic performance is not being given. If Russia's performance is below 4%, you can bet there will be internal strife within Russia and more pressure on Putin to do something about economic growth. This is the new world, not the Cold War.
Elaine, what does that mean for Europe? For a long time, between its own economic strength and the backing of the United States, it seemed that it felt pretty sturdy. What about now, Elaine?
I think it was sturdy, but it was always a work in progress, wasn't it? And now, since the Eurozone debt crisis happened in 2012, now the conversation is whether European Union should stay together, whether countries are better off in or out. There are commentators in my own paper who call it's like a marriage where divorce is more costly than staying together, but that doesn't mean that it's a good marriage. There are so many internal economic problems that it's fairly difficult for the union to look outside itself right now. But I don't think there's any sense that Europe doesn't have an important part to play in the world at all.
John in Nashua, New Hampshire. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. All I got to say is we need to stop everything else and think clearly. Russia is going to take Ukraine because it's always been theirs. Europe has been taking whatever they could from Russia, from the former USSR, for the longest time. And everybody knew this. No one was upset about it. They didn't do it by the gun. They got a different way of doing it. Russia is doing it because they need to do it. That's what they're going to do. Everybody knows this. You can have conferences all over the world. It's not going to change anything.
John, our time is short. We've got your point. I appreciate your call. Sherazad, what do you say to that very boiled-down view of this part of the world?
I think he's going to take parts of it.
i.e. Putin taking parts of Ukraine, and Europe will deal, and the rest of these borders, Estonia, Latvia, and the power formula, Europe v. Russia, status quo, or?
Status quo, I think he won't touch the Baltics because of NATO.
All right, well, maybe it sits there. Maybe it stands for now, but what a different power dynamic. And Vladimir Putin looking very carefully at it as NATO sits down in Wales today, the NATO leadership. Shehrazad Rahman at the EU Research Center, director there at George Washington University in Washington. Thank you very much for joining us today, Shehrazad.
Thank you.
And from London, Elaine Moore, capital markets correspondent for the Financial Times. Ms. Moore in London, thank you very much for your thoughts today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amato, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Amanda Gomez and Madeline Moore. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.